Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The CDC has a new director. She has a few new priorities. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. The new CDC director is Dr. Rochelle Walensky. And Dr. Cohen, she has issued a directive which suggests that it's more effective to wear not just one mask, but two of them.
You know, actually, I think it was first addressed with Dr. Fauci about, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. You know, he said wearing two masks just makes sense. But there was actually nothing, no science to support that notion. He said it just makes sense. You know, now it turns out that there was a study that was recently done by the CDC in lab tests using dummies. They exposed these two dummy heads to potentially infectious aerosols. They had one mask versus two masks. And what they found was if you use one mask, it would reduce the amount of aerosol by 40%. Mm-hmm. But if you wore two masks, it reduced it by 95%.
What do you do when you're on duty at the hospital?
So I myself wear one mask, and I've worn one mask all the time. Oftentimes, because there's a shortage of N95 masks, what people will do is they'll wear their N95 mask, but then they'll put a second surgical mask over that so that they can just replace the disposable surgical mask but keep reusing their N95 mask, which sort of, again, intuitively makes sense. Having said that, the CDC recommendation is that you don't combine an N95 mask with any other mask and that it should be used alone. They also suggest that you don't wear two disposable masks because they're not designed to fit tightly. And yet a lot of people in the hospital do wear two disposable masks.
What about these mask braces? I saw in the handout from the CDC that you sent me, there's this plastic brace that will actually press the mask firmly against your face.
Right. So the braces are probably a good idea for a variety of reasons. It creates a better fit of the mask on your face, but it also, it keeps the mask away from your mouth and away from your nose. So that should make it, number one, more comfortable so that you're not fiddling with it, which is one of the ways that you can create contamination as you touch the mask and you touch something else. The second thing is a lot of people are required to wear masks if they're going to the gym and working out. And, you know, people for sure have a sense of suffocation when they've got a mask being sucked into their nose and mouth as That's they're right. breathing harder. So the brace will help to keep it away from the face. But I don't know that they're necessarily going to create better protection from the mask other than they reduce the amount of moisture. And the mask isn't as effective when it's too moist.
The other story that you sent me was about a number of people who, after getting the vaccine, still got infected.
Yeah, so that was reported out of Oregon. So there's been four people in Oregon who were fully vaccinated, and these people have tested positive. Now, in all these cases, they all had either mild or no symptoms. They just tested positive. Mm-hmm. And I want to be clear about this. If you get a COVID vaccine, you cannot test positive from the COVID vaccine. The COVID vaccine is just mRNA. It's not the actual viral particles. So it can't cause you to have a positive test. So in these people, they had to actually have COVID or the coronavirus in order to test positive.
Right. But between the vaccine now, and I assume that we're going to be inundated with doses pretty soon, and better masking up, we should be finished with this by summer, shouldn't we?
A lot of people really are very skeptical about getting the vaccine. It's really remarkable to me that something that really is, you know, a medical achievement, getting a vaccine created in less than a year, it's really a remarkable achievement. But with that has come a certain amount of skepticism that people say, well, it happened too fast. Well, look, I've gotten both vaccines. So I, as a physician, am willing to and believe in it. I had a few side effects for a short period of time, and that was that. But, you know, people are now saying, but you don't know what's going to happen 3, 4, 5 years down the road. I have to say, I'm actually very surprised at the number of people who just say they're not going to get a vaccine or they're just going to wait and see what happens. In some cases, they're talking about waiting a few years. So we can have all the supply in the world, but if we don't have the demand, if people aren't willing to get it, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in terms of the total number of people or the percent of the population that will ultimately have it. But apparently, roughly 50 million people in this country have been vaccinated so far.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's talk about car tabs. We now have the first car tab relief bill of the legislative session. And with the story, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
The proposal comes from freshman Democratic Senator Tuana Nobles, who made car tab relief a top priority on the campaign trail last year.
I want to see relief in my community around car tabs.
She unseated longtime Sound Transit nemesis Steve O'Ban in Pierce County's 28th District, who had for years introduced bills that would have led to major car tab relief by cutting the taxes and fees and changing the valuation method. But Noble says those bills never move because they do nothing to maintain much-needed transit investments. And the fact is that as many people who want $30 car tabs, there are also many who want that transportation investment. So those bills just aren't realistic. But Noble believes her bill
that seeks to address this issue by offering a payment plan option,
which allows quarterly payments of car tab bills for everybody who pays tabs over $150, is realistic and will bring that much needed relief.
We have community members finding themselves choosing between annual vehicle registration and other essential bills.
And unlike previous bills for car tab relief, Noble's proposal allows everyone in the state, whether they're in the Sound Transit taxing district or not, to take advantage of this payment plan.
The timing was actually important. So I took time to listen to community, and I had several meetings with Department of Licensing, and I have not spoken with Sound Transit, but I believe staff and DOL have. I anticipate it will be supportive.
Nobles knows it's not the answer everyone is going to be looking for.
And I'll tell you, in the beginning, my own husband said, let me tell you, I don't want to pay the one fee that I have to pay, let alone make four payments. And I'm like, well, this doesn't work for you. But all these other people who told me that this would, you know, the single mom that I met, the people who drive electric vehicles who pay between $75 and $225, they have told me this would help them significantly. For the couples who bought those cars in December because it was a Christmas gift, but they didn't quite realize that when this financial jump happened, that every year at Christmas, it would be a financial burden paying two vehicles. This is to help those folks. This will provide financial relief for.
And she has this message for her 28th district constituents.
As we are, you know, paying more for transportation options, and I'm on the transportation committee, I am watching how many times the 28th legislature is named in these packages and budgets, and I will continue to see us represented more. And part of the issue is even community members who don't mind paying the additional taxes are not seeing the 28th benefit from some of what we're paying for. And I just want to make sure that we are, you know, doing a better job of getting those transit projects in our community. And so we know where our money is going, and we're happy to pay for it.
The bill will be heard in the Senate Transportation Committee Thursday at 1:30.
Anna Scott, so it's about time, right? I mean, this has been a burden for a long time. And years ago, I remember we were doing a discussion, had call-ins and everything. I said, so, you know, how do you want to pay for it? It was not the money. It's that to have to write a check for $300 all at once is just a financial burden. Why can't they spread the payments out? So is this going to pass?
It's got a better chance, I think, of passing than what we've seen in the past. It's a compromise, right? And exactly what you're saying. You're not going to win the battle. It's too even of a split, and especially with the makeup of the state legislature, you're not going to win the battle of not investing in transit, plus the bonding issue. So this is the compromise that I would say has the best chance of passing. We'll see how it's received at the hearing on Thursday.
Chris, what do you think? You think people will take this as progress?
Well, I think it's a good pocketbook thing, but the bottom line is no one wants to pay an unfair car tab fee. And most people believe it's an unfair car tab fee because it's not based on an actual valuation of your car. And so I think most people will be like, oh, well, this is great. I can spread it out over a couple of payments, which might be easier, but it doesn't get to the root of the problem and the fact that people voted for the $30 tabs. And they're just, I don't see people seeing this as anything better than, oh, well, okay, great. I don't have a huge bill, but you've done nothing for me on the actual problem.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, the valuation is just a way of getting more money out of people. So make the valuation fair, just raise the tax rate. Would that be better?
Well, no, I think what they do, the voters voted for something and they should get it. That being said, Sound Transit's in a world of hurt, as is every other transit agency. I mean, Sound Transit's looking at $11 billion worth of, you know, in the red right now, and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do for their money. So they need every dollar that they can get. I agree with Hannah. This, I mean, it's a positive step for people who don't like paying that $500 bill once a year. I mean, that makes sense, but it doesn't get to the root issue, which I think still has a lot of people really upset.
And so, Hannah, what is the obligation? Do you know how long it is before they could actually make a change in the rate without jeopardizing the revenue to the bondholders?
Is that for me? I think it's 2028, maybe? Am I right?
Something like, yeah, I believe so. That sounds about right.
Yeah, and the state Supreme Court has ruled on this, right? That the I-976 was clear, and there's nothing you're going to be able to do to get away from the bonding issue and all of that. So this is an opportunity to at least let you spread out the payments. And I want to say that she's still continuing to look into what else can be done down the line, possibly. She wants to hear from everybody, so she encouraged everybody with any feedback on this proposal to go ahead and email her. You can find that on the ledge.wa.gov website. And also, I have a story up on mynorthwest.com with a link. You can do all of that, have some feedback, and she wants everyone to come and testify at the hearing, which is, again, at 1:30 on Thursday in the Senate Transportation Committee. I want to hit really quickly on the fact that there is a convenience fee set on this. It's a 4% convenience fee. She was against the fact that you had to add anything when you're trying to save money, but the bottom line is it's going to cost more money to do these, you know, when you do four payments instead of one, you have to have the staff and the resources. So it's a one-time thing, 4%. So if you're paying $200, that's $8. It'll be added and split added to your payments just that one time. So
yeah, well, that's pretty standard, but I'm sure it's even more annoying to people who think it's high enough as it is.
Yeah, exactly.
To now have to pay even more.
But you wouldn't have to pay your $600 all at once. You know, if that's your situation, this will help.
Yeah, Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. A mother in Missouri was told giving birth was a threat to her health because of a rare kidney condition. But it turns out giving birth may have saved her life. Jeff Bernthal has this story.
She's wearing a face covering, but there's a big smile behind it. That's because Kebra Pebbles recently received a life-saving kidney transplant from her son, Kendall.
I feel great. I feel like a new person. I wake up, I'm not ill, I have energy.
At first, mom was not about to have her son come to her rescue. But seeing mom go through dialysis convinced Kendall to learn more about living organ donations and eventually donated one of his kidneys to help save his mom.
Just comparing now to back then, just seeing her cry every day, and I just couldn't see her like that.
Now there are tears of joy.
I'd just like to publicly thank my son for giving me life.
Peebles' condition made giving birth a risk. Following Kendall's birth and the birth of a second child, Peebles needed her first kidney transplant.
That kidney lasted 14 years before I started having complications, but it gave me 14 years of a wonderful life.
Doctors say organs from living donors often lead to better outcomes and hope people will learn more about how they can help.
Currently, there are more than 91,000 persons awaiting a kidney transplant in the United States, and this includes nearly 1,400 persons in the state of Missouri, many listed at programs in the St. Louis area.
Kendall's advice for anyone scared about donating.
I would say it's okay to be scared, because I was scared. I would say definitely look into it just to learn, you know, more about it, and don't just say no. Actually try to get more information.
Kendall's mom believes there are a lot of misconceptions out there about organ donation. She hopes by sharing her story that others will learn more about how they can help.
The mom and son spent Valentine's Day actually recovering together, which also happened to be National Organ Donor Awareness Day.
This is Seattle's Morning News, and now from 710 ESPN, Stacy Rost. And I guess since football is over, can we talk about a different sport, like
sure.
Basketball? Weren't you talking last week about the very strong possibility that there is a way to bring the Sonics back to Seattle in a timely fashion?
We were talking about the NBA's typically tepid stance on expansion, which is Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, saying, yeah, it's something that we'd like to consider eventually, maybe, but it's on the back burner, like 20 back burners back. It's not really something they're going to talk about now. So that's the way that we've always talked about it in Seattle, where almost universally, people, including outside of Seattle, think that Seattle should be a primary spot for either a relocation or an expansion team, and yet the NBA has been tepid on that. But because of COVID and each of the major leagues suffering some big losses, that has suddenly moved from the back burner to maybe like the second, third back burner, where it's not
something. This is one big stove you've got there.
It is a huge stove. It's not one, and I say that to mean it's not something the league, the NBA, is looking at right away. But it's certainly something that they're considering probably far sooner than they would have.
Well, why does COVID suddenly change the equation?
Well, COVID had a huge impact, as you know, on gate admission, ticket prices, all the ways that teams make their money and divvy that up among the other teams. So there were millions and millions and millions of dollars lost in the NFL, in the NBA, and in the MLB this year. You're going to see that reflected in, at least for the NFL, since there's no salary cap in the other sports. In the NFL, you're going to see that reflected in a lowered salary cap, where teams are going to have maybe $20 million less per team to spend. So the NBA is suddenly looking at the price of an expansion franchise, which would be maybe up to $2.5 billion, and saying, well, wait a minute, suddenly this is looking like some money we could really like here. I mean, we're talking $2.5 billion split up between the remaining teams. You'd obviously need a second team there, but there's no shortage of cities looking for teams.
Well, in the COVID world, is a franchise still worth that much if you're not guaranteed to be able to get a good gate?
I think so, especially since that $2.5 billion price tag is really high. I mean, it's not an insane number when you look at what like the Dallas Cowboys would be worth, but that's an influx of a lot of immediate money for the teams in the NBA. And obviously it's another mouth to feed, right? Because then you have another two teams that have to that you have to share the pot with. But if you're bringing in that money and then people are assuming that the vaccine will be implemented through most of the country this year, I mean, you guys know far more about that than I do, but I think the
assumption is a gamble though, right? Because if for some reason the vaccine doesn't work, or we have this new, more infectious virus, and you can't, you can only seat at what, 25% capacity or whatever compromise they come up with, suddenly your $2.5 billion investment isn't worth much.
No, exactly. I think that this is something that the NBA would be considering within a 5-year timeline as opposed to within the next 12 months.
All right. So baseball. Baseball is coming. Do you know what the Mariners' plans are? Are they still going to be empty, or do they have contingency plans to start seating people?
We don't know yet. I would assume that the league does a version of what it did earlier, which is where it either pauses or maybe extends its spring training. One thing the NBA and MLB can do that the NFL can't is they can have multiple parks in one area. The NBA obviously has a much easier time for doing this because you just need a court. But in Arizona, you have several parks that you can use if you needed to extend your spring training and kind of delay the start of the season. But they're going to wait as long as they can to do that. We haven't heard anything yet.
And hockey is still on track?
It is. So if you are not a hockey fan at all, pick a random game and just watch it. Dip, you know what I mean? Just dip your toe. Just check it out. You can do, if you play fantasy football, they have fantasy hockey that you can try. If nothing else, you can watch just a couple of games, just even for a little bit, because the expansion draft is set to take place a couple months from now, later this summer. And so some of those players you're seeing may be future Kraken players.
You know, I've been to some of the hockey games down at the Showare Center.
Oh, the T-Birds, yeah.
Yeah, the T-Birds, yeah. They put on a really fun game, and they let you throw stuff on the ice. I mean, is that is that going to happen at the Climate Pledge Arena?
I hope so. Hockey has so... I was late to hockey. Like, I didn't watch it growing up, and I got into it as an adult when a friend was telling me about her... She's a Blues fan. And there are so many weird hockey traditions that even if you are a hardcore sports fan, like if you're a hardcore Seahawks fan, you'll be like, wait, what? You guys ride the Zamboni and people throw things at you?
Right.
I don't understand. It's a culture unto its own.
Yes, it is indeed. Stacey Ross from 710 ESPN. You can hear her starting at 11. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks.
Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan, and Hannah Scott is about to join us. We are still learning more about the gunman who killed a young woman and injured another outside the Northwest African American Museum last week. Hannah Scott has the update.
The shooter, Greg Taylor, was seen walking up to the vehicle with the two women in their 20s inside as they waited to pick up a friend to head out for a road trip. He was pointing a gun into the driver's side window and later toward the front window. After the shots, the 911 call.
How many people have been shot?
Two, please come now. My friend is dying.
This all happening on the property of Urban League Village, where there are several dozen affordable housing units inside, as well as an encampment outside. And while police are not releasing much information yet, community members like Walter Jones, who was on the phone with a friend who was at the shooting scene and heard the entire thing, is sharing some details.
He's telling everybody in the building to come on out. He was going to kill everybody. And, you could kind of hear him in the background in his normal rambling or whatever you want to call it. I'm Jesus Christ. I'm a blood, I'm going to kill everybody, come outside. And you could just hear that over and over. And then you heard the couple gunshots when he shot the people in the car.
Jones says it wasn't the first time Taylor had come to the attention of people in the area.
20 to 30 interactions, with this guy, and he had a routine. At least three times a week, he would come outside anywhere from 12 o'clock at night to about 4 o'clock in the morning. He would have a routine where we just called it howling at the moon. He'd be doing circles in the Jimi Hendrix Park, and he'd be hooting and hollering about Tukey Williams, who created the Crips, and his involvement with him. And he was a blood, and he'd talk about his father, and it'd be a different tune. It'd be, I'm Jesus Christ. I'm the son of God, just random, manic things.
It also wasn't the first time police and fire interacted with him.
So this time I was parked right in front of the encampment on the walkway in my car, and he had come out about 1 o'clock in the morning, and he was doing belly flops in the grass, just full speed run, and then just like it's a slip and slide. Just, he was in all red from head to toe. He's a blood. I'm gonna kill everybody. Not engaging anybody, not coming to the encampment, coming pretty close. That night, he was pretty amped up.
But it was morning when the police were called.
As I was getting ready to leave, I was warming my car up. The fire truck pulled up, and two police pulled up, and he was in the southwest corner of the parking lot. So basically, the front side of the building where the entrance to the residence are. And he was laid out, and somebody had thought he was dead. So they called the ACAR and the police. And this isn't the police and the ACAR's first time dealing with this guy. They've dealt with him several times prior to this. And the police always come for backup because, if the ACAR people got a problem, they can't really deal with it. So the police always show up when they're called for him.
And then there was this incident last summer.
There was a drug addict that was in the park portion of the parking lot, not the residence portion. And the guy who was killed by the police was walking by, doing his thing, talking to himself. And the guy that was smoking drugs in the car rolled his window down and told the guy to get the f*** out of here. I'll kill you. What are you looking at? And then the gentleman who was killed by the police walked up and put his gun to his head. And calmly asked him, what did you say? Are you talking to me? And then, of course, the drug addict backed down and got in his car and took off.
But nobody called police as that happened. Taylor, the shooter, did maintenance work for the Urban League, according to several witnesses I've spoken with in the area. And Amari Salisbury with Converge Media says the community wants answers as to why they did nothing, despite knowing that the man had apparent mental health issues and a gun.
Is the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle. I mean, it's their quietness about the situation there. They own the building.
But Amari, I, and several other local media have been stonewalled when trying to get answers from the Urban League or their property management company. When I reached out to the Urban League, they referred me to their property management company, Coast Property Management. When I reached out to Coast Property Management regarding the incident, I got a response from their PR firm that said in part, We are heartbroken about this tragedy, and our thoughts and concerns are with the individuals involved and their families. We're limited in what we can share out of respect for the privacy of everyone involved, but we can confirm that Gregory Taylor was a resident at Urban League Village. He also worked at the building 5 hours per week cleaning the facility and grounds, which is a role he held when we took over management of the property in 2018. We follow our prescribed procedures for addressing any resident actions that violate our community standards. Those procedures include alerting building ownership and law enforcement when necessary. We are cooperating with the Seattle Police Department to assist in the investigation of this issue.
And Hannah, so what I'm hearing here is that they knew this guy had severe mental illness and they knew he had a gun.
Yes.
And nobody took action to get him committed.
Exactly. And again, I want to make clear that at least from the community members I'm talking to, this is not something that's being laid at the feet of police or fire. There's only really the couple of incidents where they've come out. As far as the mental health aspect, they probably were called out a few times more. But you know how that goes. The system just is broken. It doesn't work.
Why would anybody blame this on the police? It's not their responsibility. Somebody's got to file a complaint. So he's living right there. And he's been doing this.
And working. He works for them.
He's working there. Well, I mean, they're trying to give him a chance, right? They're trying to, I suppose, rehabilitate him, although we don't know if he's been getting any treatment or not. But this is, once again, this is the nightmare combination. Mental illness and a loaded gun. And apparently, you're telling me from this earlier incident, they knew he had the gun. No one called the police to disarm him. Do they think the Second Amendment Foundation was going to stop them? I mean, they don't endorse arming people with mental illness.
I was told from the people that I talked to that someone in the management company after the fact had reported it, like just filed a report. But, you know, after the fact, there's nothing that can be done. They didn't, you know, point to where he was or point to where the weapon was or anything like that. And I didn't get any confirmation on that from police. So that's as much as I can say about that. But yeah, this has gone on. I mean, dozens of times that there's been interactions, as you heard Walter say there in that interview. And he's the one who would go on the record with me. I've talked to many others who are not on the record who say the same thing. And one of the larger issues for this community here is that the Urban League is being so silent about this, but the Urban League is a big voice. They're the ones down in Olympia, right? That are lobbying for the change to end systemic racism, and they won't talk to their own community.
And IRPOs, remember IRPOs?
Yeah.
Seems like we were on a daily basis discussing IRPOs, the protection orders. That you have the legal mechanism now from many painful lessons learned to get people like this off the street.
Exactly. But again, I think that the sum of that is going to come back to trust in that community. They're not going to, it's tough in general for people to trust the IRPO process. And there's also not enough education about what that is to remove firearms from somebody. But I think when you've got communities that are hesitant to talk to law enforcement to begin with, and especially now in our current climate, perhaps they're not going to be willing to do that. Or maybe they don't know how. Maybe there's more outreach needed there.
Okay, but then you can't lay this at the feet of law enforcement. If you're
not. No. Not at all.
All right, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.